Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, a report on Pope Benedict's initiative regarding the Tridentine Mass. An in-depth look at all things Tridentine. And our popular Latin lover raves of the beauty of Latin prayers. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. It's been on the cards for a while. It's Pope Benedict's most recent motu proprio, a document which relaxes rules as to the celebration of the Tridentine Mass. The term motu proprio is Latin for on one own's initiative, and highlights the Pope's personal interest in this subject. My colleague Chris Altieri picks up the story.
Its title, Summorum Pontificum, comes from the first two words in the official Latin text. The document is a special kind of apostolic letter, the authority of which rests entirely on the Pope's own prerogative. Professor of Canon Law at the Pontifical Antonianum University, Franciscan Father Heinz Meinhold Stamm, explains.
The Pope, as the highest authority of the Church, can grant any act of grace spontaneously of his own free will. The act of grace, granted of his own free will, is called litterae apostolice motu proprio date, apostolic letter given of his own free will.
Even so, Pope Benedict spent more than a year in consultation with his brother bishops before releasing the motu proprio, which grants permission to use the 1962 missal to priests celebrating the Mass privately, as well as to religious communities and institutes of apostolic life. According to the motu proprio, priests may celebrate according to the 1962 missal except during the Easter Triduum and do not need the permission of the local ordinary. The faithful are also free to attend Tridentine celebrations, and parish priests are called on willingly to accept the requests of the faithful for weddings, funerals, and other occasional liturgies according to the Tridentine ritual. A four-page explanatory note accompanies the motu proprio.
There's no contradiction between the two editions of the Roman Missal. In the history of the liturgy, there's growth and progress, but no rupture. What earlier generations held as sacred remains sacred and great for us too. It cannot be all of a sudden entirely forbidden or even considered harmful. We all have the responsibility to preserve the riches which have developed in the Church's faith and prayer, and to give them their proper place. Needless to say, in order to experience full communion, priests of the communities adhering to the former usage cannot exclude celebrating according to the new books as a matter of principle. The total exclusion of the new rite would not be consistent with the recognition of its value and holiness.
In the letter, Pope Benedict also says his decision to issue the document is motivated by a desire for interior reconciliation in the heart of the Church. Dominican Father James Leachman is a professor of the Pontifical Liturgical Institute.
We were encouraged to call it organic development. It was the Mass of Paul VI was seen as a development of the Mass of Pius V in 1570.
Pope Benedict explicitly says the 1962 Missal of Pope John XXIII and the more recent Missal of Pope Paul VI, updated in 2002 by John Paul II, are two uses in the one Latin rite of the Church.
I think we want to emphasize that it's the continuity of, and the development and the renewal of the Roman Rite.
Monsignor Ignazio Barreo is director of Human Life International's Rome office. He has been using the 1962 Missal for several years under the previous rules governing its much more limited use.
I think it's very important that in this document it's clearly established this, that the 1962 Missal was never derogated or abrogated. The Latin liturgy has two uses within one rite. A larger availability of the traditional liturgy of the Church will clearly have a positive effect in the way that the Missal of Paul VI is celebrated.
The Dean of Theology and Religious Studies at the Catholic University of America is Monsignor Kevin Irwin. He says the extension constitutes an enrichment of the Church's liturgical tradition.
We had our missals, and then in 1958 began to participate with the priest in some of the prayers of the Mass. We sang Gregorian chant. We sang English language hymns. So there was a participation in many parts of the Mass. I think the bottom line is that sometimes Actuosa has been understood that we all have to keep doing something obviously and physically and vocally. That's not true. Actuosa means we participate mind and heart and will and in silence and in attitude as well as in verbal and gestural things that we do at the liturgy. Perhaps a certain level of a, dare I say, contemplative dimension of the liturgy had not been as emphasized in the 1970s as it might have been. And that kind of participation and reverence and decorum and solemnity can very well be done in the present Novus Ordo.
The Catholic Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, spoke with us about the pastoral advantages of the motu proprio.
I think what's the intention of this is really to achieve reconciliation within the Church. There are these groups who have a legitimate desire. The old rite was never abrogated. It was never, and therefore I think the Holy Father thinks, and others do as well, that if that's the case and it is a legitimate tradition of liturgy in the Church, then it should be permitted.
Pope Benedict has called on the world's bishops to share with him their experiences of the wider Tridentine use in 3 years' time. The new norms go into effect on September 14th of this year, the Feast of the Exaltation of the Cross.
Many thanks there to Chris Altieri for enlightening us on Pope Benedict's motu proprio, focusing on the Tridentine Mass. I have to confess, this issue of the Tridentine Mass has attracted an enormous amount of interest on the part of our listeners since the beginning of the year. That's why I decided to find out more about all things Tridentine. Also because, beyond those who vehemently take sides, there are also those, like myself, who simply don't know too much about things Tridentine, imagining at times that the debate is merely about language and not approach. So in an effort to find out more, I turned to a liturgist and sacramental theologian. His name is Mark Francis, and he's the Superior General of the Clerics of St. Viator. And if you stay tuned, you can hear what he told me about the Tridentine Rite. The Tridentine Mass?
Sure. The so-called Tridentine Mass is kind of a shorthand way of referring to the liturgy. The technical term is the Liturgy of Pius V, the Missal of Pius V that was promulgated in 1570.
It was supposed to last forever.
And it was expected to last forever in a real sense.
It lasted till 40 years ago.
And it lasted about 400 years until 1970, more or less. And so it was the only Eucharistic liturgy that the Latin Rite of the Roman Catholic Church had for those 400 years. But it's important to keep in mind that the Latin Rite is not the only rite within the Roman Catholic Church, that there are 22 other rites of the Church, 22 other different ways of praising God through the Eucharist, with other languages, with other calendars of saints and other practices. And so the diversity of the Catholic Church, we need to really reappropriate now that we live in a very multicultural world, and just to understand that the Latin way of doing things is not the only way.
In other words, it's not just a question of using Latin, but there was an advantage in the Tridentine Mass. It was available to everybody in the old days because of the use of the Latin language.
It's true that the parts of the priest were all in Latin, and they were invariable. They never changed. But even during that 400 years when the so-called Tridentine Rite was in use, the way in which people worshiped was very different. Take, for example, the difference between a sumptuous Mass celebrated in Austria with full choir and processions, those kind of thing, and a Mass celebrated furtively in the hedgerows of Ireland during the penal laws. The experience of going to Mass, even though the words were the same and the supposedly the rite was the same, was extremely different. And so a lot of our cultural differences in terms of how we understand worship really begin during this time when supposedly the Mass is celebrated in the exact same way throughout the world.
The word Tridentine presumably comes from Trent.
It comes from the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent, which was celebrated in the 16th century, mandated the Holy See to issue a missal purged of the abuses of the Middle Ages, because there are several problems that pertain to the celebration of the Eucharist during the Middle Ages that the Council of Trent sought to rectify. And so this missal, promulgated during the pontificate of Pius V in 1570, was indeed that missal which was purged of all those abuses.
So it's incorrect to say that the Tridentine Mass was celebrated for 1,500 years?
Oh, it's very inaccurate. Certainly the tradition of the various prayers of the Missal of Pius V, or the so-called Tridentine Mass, go back to, some of them go back as far as the 5th century, 4th and 5th century. Compositions were put together, collated, for the use of parishes here in Rome, for example. And you see evidences of it today, even in our translation, of some of the hallowed prayers of the Roman Rite. For example, the first Eucharistic prayer. The list of saints in the first Eucharistic prayer are saints that were particularly beloved to the Romans. The same thing of the naming of the various popes in the list of saints also indicates that this was a very local prayer that was later made universal.
The Tridentine Mass wasn't actually banned after Vatican II, was it?
Well, the Tridentine Mass, when the promulgation of the new missal took place, was in a certain sense overshadowed, because there was never a time in the history of the Church where we had two official rites. Holy Father John Paul II gave an indult to people who were so attached to the old rite that for their spiritual benefit, he enabled priests to offer this Mass for them so that they wouldn't be discouraged, that they could continue going to Mass in the old way. It was meant as a kind of a means of helping people in their spiritual life, especially those older people who found it hard to adapt. Because that was a sense of the indult that was given in the 1980s.
So what happened with Lefebvre then? Was he given an indult? But he was excommunicated for different purposes, no?
Well, I think it's important to understand that whether or not one accepts the Roman Rite or the new liturgy of Vatican II is an indication if does one accept the teachings of the Ecumenical Council of Vatican II as well. And in the case of Archbishop Lefebvre, he not only rejected the Mass, the liturgy of Vatican II, or the Missal of Paul VI, he basically rejects the Vatican Council. Vatican Council II. And so as a result, the product of this council is indeed the liturgy, and so it was for him a kind of a sign or a symbol of his rejection of what he considered to be a deviation in the history of the Church. That is also, to a certain extent, the case of some of the other groups that have broken from the Roman Catholic Church and who insist on celebrating the liturgy according to the Tridentine fashion. The basic problem with all this is that it's a doctrinal problem as well as a liturgical problem. And those who refuse to accept the new liturgy and consider it illegitimate basically also consider Vatican II illegitimate.
Is part of the Tridentine Rite for the priest to celebrate with his back to the congregation?
Indeed. That's part and parcel of the way in which the rite is celebrated. It's a question of mediation in a certain sense, where if you look at the Tridentine Rite, the priest was the mediator between God and the people, and he stood between the altar and the people and that kind of represents that kind of a mediation. After Vatican II, we turn the altars around, and the priest faces the people with the table between them, in a real sense saying that this table is a common table, belongs to all of the Christians gathered, and therefore the presence of Christ is in our midst, not being drawn down upon the altar from heaven above. And in a real sense, that shift exemplifies well some of the teachings of the Second Vatican Council.
So what's the interest in talking about the Tridentine Mass right now, if some people are allowed to celebrate the Tridentine Mass anyway?
Well, I think they're allowed to celebrate it only by way of exception, and not by way of just a general way of celebration. I think that particular discipline is rather important, because indeed we only have one rite, the Latin rite of the Roman Catholic Church, and that is the rite that was approved by Paul VI, the Vatican II liturgy, which best exemplifies or best illustrates who we are as Church, what we believe today as Christians in terms of our understanding of Church, understanding of sacraments, all those things are encompassed in the celebration itself. part of the problem today, I still think, even 40 years after the Council, was that the way in which the liturgical changes were introduced and these changes in custom and this kind of thing, we didn't do it very well. We didn't give very much catechesis. We simply, from one day to the other, we changed the liturgy without giving people time to really think about what these changes might mean and how, indeed, that they illustrate the teachings of the Second Vatican Council. And so as a result, there are some people, and many of those people found themselves, in a certain sense, disagreeing with the Church, who find themselves outside the Church because they don't understand why the changes were made.
Does one say Tridentine Mass or Tridentine Rite?
Well, you know, there's the Tridentine Rite of Mass. There's also the Tridentine Rites of the sacraments can be celebrated in the Tridentine way. And, for example, you know, when we could celebrate a funeral with the Tridentine Rite, which is always, it would be the Dies Irae, for example, which is the Days of Wrath, and it's a long Latin hymn that was sung at every funeral that speaks of the Days of Wrath and the Second Coming of Christ and the Judgment and all that. All that was changed with Vatican II. It's a beautiful hymn, the Dies Irae, but it's also very, very scary in a real sense. And so part of the liturgical reform after Vatican II was to take another look at how these sacraments or in this case, a funeral was celebrated, to talk about Christian hope, Christian life, how the gospel itself gives us a cue in terms of understanding what happens to us at death. That's not to say that the Dies Irae was illegitimate, that it wasn't a good thing necessarily for its time, but that now, after several centuries of Christian living, we have another attitude or another way of understanding a Christian death and how to celebrate it.
I think you'd like to add on the Tridentine Mass.
The Tridentine Mass served the Church well for several centuries. But in a real sense, after the Council of Trent, the Tridentine Mass was established in such a way that it could only be celebrated in one particular way. The rubrics or the ceremonial directives were invariable. It was hedged around by law, and it was estimated, for example, that a priest, in celebrating the Mass, could sin hundreds of ways. And some of those ways were mortal sins. And that's in the introduction to the Tridentine Mass. We have a different attitude today in terms of how we understand the liturgy and how the priest and the people need to celebrate it. We don't emphasize the fact that if you deviate from the rubrics that there's a sin involved, though I think we probably have all experienced the fact that there are times where you know that the priest is sinning liturgically if he deviates too much from what the basic rite is supposed to be. The Tridentine Rite, which was in vigor for 400 years, in a certain sense was an anomalous time in the Church. Because before that time, the rites, the liturgy of the Mass, liturgy of the various sacraments, developed and changed over the course of each century. It was only with Trent in 1570 and the possibility of making everything uniform through the use of the printing press that made the liturgy fixed and stable.
There's not only the use of Latin in the Tridentine Mass, there's Hebrew as well, and then there's lots of silence in the Tridentine Mass, no?
Well, I mean, there's Aramaic, there's Hebrew, there's Greek. I once gave a talk about, they gave me the title for this talk, Whatever Happened to the Kyrie? And someone stood up at the end of my talk and said, yes, we want to bring back the Latin Mass, we want to be able to sing Kyrie again. Well, Kyrie is Greek, it's not Latin. it comes from that interchange between the Eastern and Western churches. The rite itself, the traditional rite, was something that, for example, in the Holy Holy, and they're talking about returning to this phraseology of the
Sanctus.
Holy, or the Sanctus, Holy Holy Holy, Lord God Sabaoth. Lord God of power and might. Sabaoth is Hebrew for God of the armies. So, I mean, the translation is always going to be limping in terms of how we're going to understand God. But there's an instance of that even in the ancient Latin where they preserve certain words from Hebrew and from Greek.
My thanks there go to liturgist and sacramental theologian, Superior General of the Viatorians, Father Mark Francis, for so generously sharing with us his expertise. And finally, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster.
My voice.
Your voice is a little blob on the computer.
It's just a little blob. We all are blobs in life, anyway.
How do you say blob in Latin?
Blob is macula. Macula sumus in vita.
So, Father Foster, are you getting ready for school? What are you preparing for school?
Well, we have all authors from every age, and it's a lot of fun for me because they have to see real people. And so I print up text, about 50 pages of texts, which I have to do these next couple days.
So
everyone, Plautus, I'm going to give them Benedict's first speech to the cardinals.
Okay, I have it here. So,
which I just happened to write myself, but that's all right. Want to see modern Latin? Boom. Here it is.
I've picked out a few things on Benedict's first speech to the cardinals. It's this one, right? Where he says, "If the weight of the responsibility that now lies on my poor shoulders is enormous, the divine power on which I can count is surely immeasurable."
Mm.
So how do you say that?
Well, I don't know how I said it. I must have said it.
So what was special about this Latin that Pope Benedict used? I mean, we discussed Pope Benedict's knowledge of Latin, no?
Yes.
Right when he was elected. So how has he come on? How do you think?
I mean, he likes it and appreciates it and wants people to know it. But that's about it. And then what? Practically, what they're going to do about this, you know, how do you get people to know it? Well, you saw in his compendium of the catechism, have you looked at the compendium?
Yes, I have.
And the last pages, they have all the prayers and things that he would like people to know in Latin. Our Father, Hail Mary, the Creed, etc., etc., all in Latin. That's what he wanted. Afraid of course, not only in his case, but they don't realize what it takes to know Latin. He knows Latin, it's obvious. And it's been his whole life has been every day dealing with this stuff. He doesn't even think about it, got it?
I think it's time to speak about the Second Vatican Council, because that's when the living language was Latin, no?
Mm-hmm.
Can one say that at the time of the council?
Oh, there's no question about
Latin
it.
Latin was a living language.
That's what I'm saying. He just took the thing for granted. And Felici, and Archbishop Felici, and everyone was speaking Latin.
Summus Pontifex, normas edet ad predictas leges exequendas.
It was just taken for granted. Everything was done in Latin. But you see, this is almost 40, 50 years ago.
And since then, Latin has got squelched.
Well, yes, certainly.
How do you say squelched?
Well, it hasn't been
Latin?
Squelched. It hasn't been oppressa est, well, no. But it was just neglecta est. It's just been, it has been neglected, put off on the side. That's the problem. So now we're missing about two or three generations of Latin teachers. The younger priests and younger bishops don't know Latin. And now what do you do? Well, anyway, I'm glad I'm not in charge. I'm in charge of my classroom. Some of the best students in the world of Latin, for Latin and so forth and so on. But in the church, forget it.
Do you think that your students say their prayers in Latin?
They do. I know they do. I know they do. And some of them are atheists and others are Jews. half of the students were Jewish this year in summer school. For sure. And they go crazy over this stuff, Latin and Gregorian chant. So they say, well, what about the future of Latin? I'm optimistic on my part. For the church, no, I'm not optimistic at all. But that's their business.
Do you ever study Gregorian chant, what's written in the Gregorian chant?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
In school, for example? Certainly.
We did when we were little children in Catholic school. And I present this and explain this to the students. These are graduate students from Harvard, Cambridge, Oxford, and all this other stuff. And they want to know this.
So give me the top 10 of Gregorian chant.
What do you mean the top 10?
The top 10
pieces.
Yes. How do you say that, top 10 favorites?
Amatissima, Decem, Maxime, Exempla. That would be the top 10. Well, I'll tell you one of them. One of the students go crazy. Which are St. Thomas Aquinas. His Eucharistic hymns. Well, they don't have any idea about the Eucharist. But, you know, Adoro te devote latens deitas. Adoro te devote latens deitas. We sing this stuff in
what does it mean in English?
Well, I adore...
Which is the living language today, by the way.
Well, your language, not mine, anyway. I adore you devoutly, hidden deity. And we sing this in the church. This is the year 1208. In the church where practically he died. He died right behind it, about 20 feet away. St. Thomas died there. And I bring the students there and we sit in the pews and sing his Eucharistic hymns. And they won't move. Fossa Nova.
Oh, in Aquino.
Certainly, to Aquino. You can go down there and
south
sit there.
Rome.
They have a brand new floor. It's out of this world. And I'm sitting there with the students. I said, by the way, our friend Antonio down the road is waiting for us, and he has pizzas and bruschetta and everything else for 50 people. At 7 o'clock, and the students said, no.
We want to go on singing.
Yes, we want to sing the whole thing. I said, I don't care who sings.
So most of these students are not Catholics.
No, most of them are not Catholic. It's beautiful to see. I mean, it's like, you know, they're like they're studying, you know, Mozart or Beethoven or Bach or something like this. These are values, precious things.
It could snowball too, no?
I don't know to what. I hope, maybe.
Something good.
I'm
how do you say snowballing?
Snowballing. Augescere. Potestatim augescere in rem maximam. It could snowball into a big thing. No, we'll see what's going to happen. I'm getting ready for school, and I'll do my share.
Hartel, thanks there once again to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.